Welcome to the Heartbreak Kids Podcast, where we explore what connects us all in our yoga practice and in our lives. This is where I talk to people about their stories, who they are, what they've been through, and where they're going. And in this podcast, that's what we explore. I believe deep down inside, we're all connected, which explains why we bring ourselves to the top of our mat every day. Welcome to the Heartbreak Kids. So welcome to the next edition of the Heartbreak Kids. I'm here with Robin Ward, and I met her a few years in Mysore, and I was assisting in the shala, and I remember this, you know, this young woman coming into the shala with really long hair and me helping her with back bends like several times, like over the month. And I got to know her over the last few trips to Mysore, India, and I'm having her on the show today just to learn a little bit more about her and her journey towards yoga. So thanks for being on the show, Robin.
Thank you so much for having me. Hi, Sheila and everyone.
Yeah, for all the listeners out there, I think that a lot of people are really intrigued by Robin, you know, in the Instagram world. And so, like, I wanted to have you on the show because I think, you know, you carry yourself, like, really good with the practice. But you're welcome. And I don't think that, but I don't feel like people know who Robin is. And
right.
So like, and maybe you do that on purpose. and that's cool. I get it. Boundaries are key, right? But, you know, I want to know a little bit about like Robin, who she was like when she was in high school and when she was in college. So can you give us a little background information?
Okay. Well, yeah, it's funny because I have listened to a couple of the podcasts, as I said, and I hear you ask that question. And I thought to myself, like, ooh, that's interesting because I normally keep that aside. Like, I sometimes don't really go into that. But before I started practicing or before I even had an interest in yoga, I was one of those people that were inherently super lazy.
I don't see you as lazy.
Yeah, right. So I had more of a stagnant lifestyle when I was younger.
No sports or anything?
No, nothing at all. I was creative at home, but never on a steady basis, like painting and things like that, but never consistent. And I would do everything I could to avoid sport, really. I would like bunk when I had to do it at school, the other day in conference, actually, Shiraji brought it up. He was like, that classic quote that we hear all the time, you know, that like anybody can practice, old, sick, you know, whatever, except only lazy people cannot practice. And I think the only reason why that phrase works is because once a person starts practicing, whether they're lazy to begin with or not, they become not lazy. And so that kind of happened to me.
Yeah, I feel like it sort of motivates people to, or inspires them to get on the purpose of what their life is supposed to be about.
Totally.
Yeah, and so it gets people off the couch, or it gets people out of the house, or gives them sort of motivation, or gives them a community. I mean, it can give them like many different things for sure. But I'm interested in why you choose not to share about like your past. Was there a rough past, or you just choose not to talk about it?
I think it's just part of my personality.
Okay.
Like even when I was younger, I didn't really. I haven't really been so good at expressing who I am or myself. And I think I'm more of a server than a person that needs to always be in the limelight.
Mm-hmm.
And so you brought up the Instagram thing. I mean, that's never really been part of my character. And it's definitely a huge part of my generation, the social media thing.
Sure.
But I got Instagram really late, just a couple of years ago. And also Facebook, I got like after it had already been out for ages, you know, like
too.
Everybody had one except me. And then you kind of learn that you can be somebody on social media, and then you can be your private self at home.
Yeah.
And so I'm not embarrassed about who I was before, although, like everybody, there are things in my life that I wish I had done differently.
Of course.
But yeah, I'm just quieter.
Yeah, I didn't get social media until a little bit later, and my wife didn't get it until like a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only because I told her there was like mom groups on Facebook. I was like, there's mom groups that can like support you with the kids and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And then she got involved with that. So it's definitely part of the generation. Like, I mean, I feel like everyone is on it to a certain degree.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the real downfall to it is that people like aren't their authentic self. You know, like,
right.
You know, or they make up who they are instead of, you know, like really being who they are. And
totally.
Yeah. And I have a real problem with that too. It's like, cause it just comes across as ingenuine or whatever.
Well, people are so multidimensional. We have so many layers. And even when we're just speaking to someone in conversation, we won't bring up everything,
you know, of course.
Or we'll keep certain things that we're struggling with in life. Quiet because we don't want to come across as, unstable or
sure.
needy, or we prefer to listen to what other people have to say rather than talk so much ourselves. And then social media, we just show what we want to, you know, just like one little bit. And maybe it's genuine, but it's because it's only one aspect and you're seemingly hiding a lot of other stuff,
yeah. Then
it maybe comes across as ingenuine.
Yeah. Yeah, so tell us about how you fell into a yoga class. Yeah, how did this lazy person go from, you know, in her house, creative, doing art and painting and stuff in their house to all of a sudden, like, taking an Ashtanga yoga class?
Right. Well, I'll just rewind a little bit. I was super lazy when I, when I was, 16 and before,
mm-hmm.
and then I went to boarding school in South Africa,
okay.
and sport was compulsory.
Okay.
There was nothing you could do to really get out of it, and in any way that I could, I did, but every now and again, I did do some things, and it really, really helped my confidence levels. And
what kind of sports?
or
they made you do a little bit of everything.
But. Yeah, they did make us do a little bit of everything, but I did like the easier, like I never did hockey, for example, you know what I mean? Like I did social tennis and like fast walking.
So, so you could still talk and walk.
Totally.
Yeah.
But I still had to put on the clothes and go out there in front
sure.
of other people, and it really made me more confident. And so when I finished high school, I took a gap year and I went back to Dubai where my parents lived. And my aunt was living there at the time as well. And she had been practicing yoga for many years, maybe like 30 years.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
That's a long time.
Yeah, it is.
Wow.
Not Ashtanga, but just Hatha Yoga asanas, and now she's doing Yin Yoga. I think she's very free, which is a wonderful quality of hers. And so she invited me to go to a yoga class with her, and I went. And because of the person that she is, she was so encouraging. She was like, "Oh my gosh, you did so well. You're so flexible, even though you've never done yoga before. I couldn't touch my toes, you know? So like, compare that to this." And I hadn't seen yoga. It wasn't popular
sure. Where
I was. And I hadn't seen people putting their legs behind their head. The first time I saw anybody catching in a backbend was here.
Oh, wow.
And I was kind of horrified.
Yeah,
I was like,
that is
not happening to
like,
me.
It looks like, it looks like a scary monster or something.
It totally looks like something from Cirque du Soleil. It's just like normal bodies are
like
not made for that.
Or something,
right.
Or exorcism or something along those lines. But yeah, it looks crazy for sure.
Yeah. So I was like, wow, I'm good at this, you know, like even like I just thought this is great. I'm enjoying it a lot. And I started going a couple of times a week because I had so much free time. And then I stopped doing it for a while because I just had other interests and had more friends. And story could just go on and on.
Yeah, and so it wasn't a Ashtanga class. It was like a Vinyasa class, or it was a Hatha class?
Yeah, I actually asked the teacher after a couple of months of practicing there, like, what kind of yoga is this? Because I'd only just discovered that there were different types of
sure.
practices. And he said, it's a mixture of hatha and power yoga. And he didn't even seem so sure about what it was. So
yeah, those are like two polar opposites. Well, actually, they're not. But yeah, in contemporary language, that seems a little polar opposite.
So sure. I mean, we weren't necessarily doing vinyasa. Sometimes we would just let's do this asana. Let's do this asana. You know. But he did try to cultivate a sense of mindfulness. Or obviously, when I say mindfulness, I mean like mind emptiness.
Sure.
Yeah. Or mind stillness. And I think that was really important for me, because as an inherently lazy person, maybe maybe instead of lazy, we can say like the person that takes convenience.
Yeah.
So
chooses comfort over,
right?
Yeah.
So there's nothing wrong with sometimes being comfortable and sometimes going outside of your comfort zone. That's a good balance. But
sure,
lazy has such a lot of negative connotations. So the body's inherent state of comfortableness is resting,
right?
And the mind's most inherent state of comfortableness is to wander and flit from topic to topic and be totally erratic.
Oh, right.
Right. So with yoga, we try to convince the mind to be steady and to be still. And so that really, really helped me to come out of something that would really take hold of my mind, which is to overthink.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's almost like a cycle that you can't get out of. The more you think, the more you think.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's a rabbit hole.
Yeah.
It's a whirlpool. It sucks you in and you can't get out.
Totally. Yeah. And it's damaging as well, because even if it doesn't start out self-destructive, I think really overthinking things and overthinking what you look like to other people or this and that, I don't know, my personal tendency is like that, then it can damage your self-esteem.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I also think that about 90% of the things that we say to ourselves are negative. You know, it's like even if we start positive,
right,
then eventually like it goes down, like somehow you don't add up or you're not part of or you're different than any of that stuff, and it draws separation.
For sure. And
yeah,
we all have failures. We all fall short
totally
sometimes.
Yeah.
And there are times in my life that I'm like super not proud of. Like I had to repeat a year at university, and like it's already bad.
Yeah.
So then to make it like worse and worse and worse, like I can't believe I did that. I let my parents down.
Yeah.
I didn't do a good job, and you know, it really, really affected me badly. And this practice, the Ashtanga practice, actually really pulled me out of that.
Yeah.
And really helped me to focus my mind.
Gotcha. And awesome. When you were in that first yoga class where that guy was describing the hatha and power, was it something that you felt very drawn to? Like, I mean, not necessarily that practice, but like the yoga practice in general. Like, did you immediately fall into it and like be like, oh yeah, this is something that I want to do?
I did.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because of the mindfulness and because of the emptiness that you were talking
just
about?
Just because of the way that it made me feel. I don't think it consciously made me feel like, oh, wow, I can control that nagging mind that I have. But more, it just kind of happened passively. And I just felt a lot better,
yeah,
a lot better about myself. I made decisions a lot easier, because as a chronic overthinker,
right,
if you can use that term, it was very difficult for me to make decisions. And so people would have to wait on me, or I just, like, lost my train of thought.
Yeah, it's okay. I mean, it seems like, you know, the yoga's like giving you an opportunity to just kind of almost like clean up your life to a certain extent, like mentally, giving you like a bunch of positive stuff.
And passively in the beginning as well, because I didn't realize how much it was helping me. I just knew that I felt really good, and that when I didn't do it, I didn't feel as good.
Yeah. And so how often were you doing it?
In the beginning, just like 3 times a week, because that's when my aunt was going, and I just went with her.
Got it.
And then I made some more friends because I had just gone back to Dubai and I was taking this gap year. So, like, in the beginning, I was going a lot with my aunt, and then I made some more friends and wanted to do some things in the evenings. And then I wasn't really going to yoga that much anymore, but I didn't feel like I was. I guess I didn't realize that you have to do it regularly to make it a part of your life, or to make it, because I just felt like it would always be there, you know, for when I wanted. But obviously, after a while, I realized I do a lot better when I do it regularly.
Yeah, I find that if I do it more often, it's like sometimes I don't even like taking a rest day. I have to like force myself to take a rest day because because of how differently you perceive the entire world. It's like, you know, how I behave with my children and how I am with my students and my wife and, you know, like the cashier at the supermarket or whatever. It's like every exchange is totally different. It's like night and day. You know, after practicing yoga, I feel like it's just really powerful shift perspective.
So do you feel like it makes you a lot calmer in your interactions, or do you feel like you just are able to be more empathic or empathetic?
I mean, I think both, actually. Mm. It gives me a second to not be reactive to everything.
Yeah.
That's what I've found. And with that, like, non-reactive space, I can go to empathy a lot quicker. Where instead it's like, I want what I want when I want it right now.
Right.
Hurry up. Like, you know, like, like the good American that I am. It's like,
right.
It's
so like, it makes you patient.
Totally.
And that is, that's such a cool point to bring up, because that's like one of the main things that I got from the Ashtanga practice specifically, and not really from other types of yoga that I had tried before, is restraint.
Yeah.
And just the ability to be like, I'm experiencing this now, and I'm going to stay here instead of trying to jump ahead.
Yeah.
You know, and you learn that because you have to follow your breath. So even, so it's like on the mat and you're like, okay, this is chaturanga. It's super uncomfortable, but I'm going to finish my exhale and then I'm going to inhale to upward facing dog.
Right.
And it's a separate thing. But then, of course, you get those students that are like, chaturanga upward facing, you know?
Yeah, they're moving like really fast.
They're like, how do I get out of this?
Yeah.
So, so that person that is inherently like that can learn to experience chaturanga, for example, on the mat.
Yeah.
Then they take it out and they're out of the mat and they're like, oh, okay, this is my experience. Now I'm having this experience and now I can respond instead of react.
Yeah, that's exactly like, I feel like one of the big lessons that I've been able to take away from it. It's like, it just gives me restraint.
Yeah.
It gives me a pause before I...
Powerful.
And so tell me how you showed up to your first Ashtanga yoga class.
Right.
And why did you go to an Ashtanga yoga class? It's like, you know, I feel like when people are telling other people to go to like an Ashtanga class, they're always like, oh, this is the hardest class ever. It's a Mysore class. We don't know what, like how to describe it. You know, it's like, so how did you end up at your first one?
So a few years later, so I started practicing yoga when I was 18, and then I started practicing Ashtanga when I was like 21 or 22, I think. And then, so it was just the closest yoga to my house. And Sharmal, who was my best friend in high school, Ethan, my brother's girlfriend now, she was also living with me at the time in Barcelona, and she started practicing because it was just the closest to the house. And I was like, oh, okay, I also want to try yoga again because I hadn't practiced in a long time. And I also, I never gave much thought to the fact that there were different types of yoga, so I didn't really look into it. And I went there at a time of my life when I was struggling a lot, because this is the year that I had to repeat. It was actually when I was coming to the realization that I was going to be repeating a year.
Which can be heartbreaking.
It was. Yeah. It was. I felt like I had, you know, like my whole world was falling apart. And at the same time, I was kind of like trapped in this weird, I don't want to say depression, because I feel like other people suffer so much more than me, but I wasn't happy and I wasn't comfortable to leave the house, which is a really strange thing to be trapped in. I just like, when you are an overthinker, sometimes you can feel a little bit paranoid.
Yeah.
And obviously, I think this is sounding a lot more serious than it really was, but I felt like when I went out that people were always looking at me.
Yeah.
And sometimes I still have that. Like, sometimes I'm walking in the street or something and I'm like, everyone's looking at me.
Yeah.
Why are they looking at me? But so I was going through that weird phase and staying at home a lot.
Yeah.
And sometimes not even leaving the house to go to the store, or just like staying at home a lot. So just to like, she was like, let's go to yoga. And I went and everybody like was looking at their own drishti, and the teacher just helped me a little bit. And then I had to do it by myself.
Yeah.
So it taught me how to be responsible for myself from day one. Like, I have to remember how to do this confusing sun salutation, and it was really confusing for me.
Yeah,
I was like,
part.
How am I going to remember this?
I'm like, the new people that walk into my room, I'm like, please God, like, let this information come through clearly. You know, it's like a dance, you know, it's like you're teaching someone a tango
totally.
Or something. It's like, and yeah, it just throws people off. It's like, oh, and this is also the easiest part, but it's also the hardest part because you're going to be sweating your ass off, you know, it's like,
yeah,
there's so many different aspects to it, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And so that's how I came to my first Ashtanga class, and it really helped me to feel more confident, and suddenly I didn't feel like everybody was looking at me, and I realized much later that I probably felt like people were looking at me because I was not looking hard enough at myself.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was not doing the best that I could do, because I wasn't showing up for myself and like doing well at university.
Yeah.
And so I felt, you know, that feeling of you're in trouble.
Yeah.
I had that feeling so strong, and it was just the worst feeling ever. And so,
it can be debilitating, and also, I mean, so much anxiety that goes
totally.
Along with, I mean, even the fact that you feel like people are looking at you and, you know, paranoia. I've had all of those things,
right.
You know, that you're describing.
And so this practice is wonderful for melting that away, because
yeah.
it makes you proud of yourself.
Sure.
You know, just for going, just for being there.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it was really, it's a challenge for me to get on the mat every day.
Yeah.
It
and
is.
This depression that you, or this period that you were talking about, like, you know, have you had any after you started the Ashtanga practice?
I think it's a part of me.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very easy for me to fall into that and to just be like, I didn't do well at this. Like, I recently separated from my partner.
Mm-hmm.
And when we did, like, for a very long time in the relationship, I had been like really trying really hard to be better at it, you know, to give him like everything that he needs.
Sure.
And at the end, he basically just said that even when everything was totally perfect, it still wasn't enough. And I felt like it was really difficult for me to hear.
Yeah.
And it really brought back that feeling of like, wow, you did a really, you know, bad job.
Yeah.
And, but I was able to come out of it so much quicker. You know, I had that same heavy feeling, and then I was able to be like, that just wasn't the perfect moment for me, and now I'm going to move on and try to show up for myself more.
Yeah.
And I think that when you're able to make yourself happy and be there for yourself more, then you can coexist with somebody else. And so
yeah.
that's why that just wasn't working. It's because there was too much pressure that I was putting on myself to show up for him.
Yeah.
I think that, yeah, that was just my own mistake, really.
It's interesting, too, that you bring that up, because, like, one of the things that the reason why I feel like E and my wife work so well
mm-hmm.
is because she has her own friends. She has, like, you know, she takes care of her sobriety. I don't help her with her sobriety. She doesn't help me with my sobriety. You know,
right.
there's like things that we're like really responsible for that we take care of. You know,
yeah.
it's like we fill up our own cup. We make ourselves feel good. We're better together. But alone, we can stand on our own 2 feet.
And that is so awesome.
Yeah. And that's like one of the things that like real, like recovery is taught us. It's like, you have your own sponsor, you take care of this. If you're not feeling good about something, you need to take care of your side of the street. And it's like really a powerful thing because relationships are, I mean, they're so tricky, you know, yeah. They're like the trickiest things yeah. ever. It's like how to, be with someone for long periods of time is a very difficult thing. So thanks for sharing.
Or even just find someone that you actually want to be around for that long, you know? It's yeah. kind of like, that was my first boyfriend that I, like real boyfriend that I ever had, you know? Yeah. And I'm 30. Yeah. So yeah, and I think that when something takes so long to come about, you kind of feel like I have to hold on to this with all my might, and in the end that's the biggest problem.
Yeah.
And that will also be the biggest problem in your relationship with your practice, is if you're constantly like holding something so tightly.
Right.
You know, so you have to learn to also cultivate a certain level of stillness in your practice, and so through life, you can learn more about how to interact with your practice, and through practice, you can learn more about how to interact with the rest of your life.
Yeah. What other lessons has the practice taught you?
What other lessons?
It's a loaded question.
Yeah, it really is.
I mean, it's like nonstop. It's like it's taught me so much that it's just like, you know, you give it a general question like that and it's almost impossible to answer because the list is so long, you know?
Right. Well, I mean, I could probably think of, like, off the top of my head, in some ways, which it has really changed my lifestyle
mm-hmm.
and just really helped me to be a better version of myself, because I think that's the main motivation that I have for stepping onto the mat every day. Because my body is not the kind of body that I stepped on my mat and put my leg behind my head. I had to practice my full practice every day in order yeah. to be able to keep on doing it. I had a really bad headache once for like almost 2 weeks, and I went to the hospital, and that was the only time in my 7 and a bit years of daily Ashtanga practice that I didn't practice.
Wow.
So in that time, I then had to like relearn how to land in Karandavasana, relearn like slowly like to put my leg behind my head just from taking a short period of time right. off. So my body like closes
really fast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I got it back quite quickly, but sure. I mean, it took me a little while. So.
And it's quite painful to open it up again. Yeah. It's like, why does this hurt so bad?
Yeah, right. But it also feels good in a way. You're like, oh, I'm just like, I have to sit with this experience and I have to learn it. So, I mean, to bring Ashtanga off the mat and into my life has kind of just become, it's just kind of like a second nature. So my lifestyle kind of revolves around the practice, and I think it makes my life a lot better. So I don't live to practice, but at the same time, the practice influences my life so much
yeah.
that it molds my day. And the way that my day is structured now actually makes me definitely the best version of myself.
Because of the discipline?
For sure.
Okay.
Yeah. So I try to be more free. And especially when I was in relationship, I tried really hard to be more free. But I find that cultivating a lifestyle suitable for practice is totally key to somebody that is a daily Ashtanga practitioner. So, like, for example, going to bed early enough that you can wake up the next morning.
Sure.
I mean, you can have a practice and you can have a good teacher that only teaches you asanas when you're ready for them and that kind of thing. But at the end of the day, your practice is only going to be sustainable if you are able to get enough sleep and eat enough of the right food.
Right.
And that doesn't mean that I'm always like that. But certainly I go to bed a lot earlier than I did before I started this practice. And I try to cultivate intermittent fasting. I think that there's a lot of negative things written about it on the internet, but I think it goes really well with the Ashtanga practice. And I'm not a doctor, so I'm not encouraging the listeners to go ahead and like stop eating for like 18 hours a day. No. I think that it's cool to try it, or if you, or you could try like, I'm not going to eat for like this many hours, you know, that is similar to what I'm already doing, and then see how it works for you. But I think it works really well for me, because practicing on an empty stomach is definitely very helpful.
Totally. Yeah. I've found that intermittent fasting is almost happening naturally to a lot of Ashtanga practitioners.
Right.
Yeah, where it's not, we just don't need the big portions. We don't need three or four meals, or I guess the new knowledges or new wisdom about it is that it's five meals that you're supposed to be having or whatever.
Right. Like, there's always something.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's like, but I feel like there's this period of time where I just don't need food, you know, and sometimes it's from 5 p.m. all the way until like, you know, the next morning.
Yeah, for sure.
Until 10 o'clock or something like
that. Definitely. If you're practicing at like 5 or something like that, then yeah, to stop eating at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I think it's a good time to stop eating. And then obviously that affects like your relationships and things like that. So I wouldn't recommend being so very strict on that. I think that sometimes, like especially me, because it's easier, or it's my lazy way out, to have some kind of a schedule in this. So it's actually easier for me to go to bed earlier, because then my practice is easier.
Yeah.
You know?
I know that I'm going to bed at 6:30. Like, I remember a period of time where I was working really hard, like in my practice, because I was just trying to get over a little bit of stagnation period. And I was like giving so much effort. And then I would get home and I'd be like, I would go to bed at like 6:30 in the evening or whatever. And the kids are like, Dad, why are you going to bed? The sun is still out. Yeah, you're right. I need a little bit more freedom in my life. You know, like, it's crazy. So,
yeah.
But it's good. The practice definitely has like this almost holistic, you know, it, or it makes you look at every area of your life and examine it and take you in different areas and say like, does that work for me or does it not work for me? It's really interesting to like talk to as many people as what I have about the practice
see
like how, you know, like what the routine is like, you know, there's been a couple that practice in the evening and there's been a couple that, you know, aren't vegetarians. And I'm like, what is going on here?
Yeah.
You know, there's so many different avenues, but it's really interesting to talk to as many people and be like, you know, this is the thing that is important to me right now.
Totally. So, and the practice helped shape that for me and make that part of my routine in life. And also being vegan, I think that...
You're vegan?
I'm vegan.
Okay.
I was vegetarian since I was a kid.
Okay.
My parents were not very stoked on that, but I was pretty insistent. And I was the only vegetarian in my family. I think the first time that I wanted to do it, I was like 5 or 6 or something.
Oh, wow.
And they were just like, oh no, this is a total pain in the ass. Can you please just eat what everybody else is eating? And then I did until I was 12. And then I was like, you know, actually, I think I'm just going to make my own.
Yeah.
And then I was just eating like, then they got used to it. And they were like, okay, well, let's just make this part separately. And then, you know, I would be able to eat with them for sure. And it wasn't really a problem after a while. I mean, it kind of broke my grandma's heart because she was like, oh my gosh, my grandchild is going to die. And I was like, you have diabetes and you're eating bread. You're going to die. So every time we see each other, it's like, ah.
Yeah, I don't think, a lot of people just don't understand it. They just don't understand it. It's like, no, you're not going to be able to eat enough. It's like, no, I'm fine. I'm not obese. And, you know, it's like, like, I'm feeling good in my body. So,
but she's Portuguese and I'm not a thin person. I'm an average person. So when she sees me as a Portuguese person, she thinks that I look like extremely thin.
Yeah.
So she's like really concerned. But anyway, so like maybe a year into my Ashtanga practice, I became vegan.
Okay.
And I just, I think I'd seen some horrific things and I just felt like this is not in line with the yamas and like what I want to be cultivating within my life. And, you know, so I became vegan And definitely there's some debate about it, and I really don't want to encourage people to be vegan. I think it's always good to try things slowly and see how you feel. But the first month of being vegan was super difficult, and then after that I felt so much clarity, and I think it was also spiritual clarity, and I think it went really well with my practice, and I think it still does.
Yeah, that's awesome. I've experienced the same thing, although I do eat pizza, so then like, it throws off everything. I've been a vegetarian for a long time, and it's like my kids went the other way. You went towards vegetarian. My kids are all like, no, Dad, I don't want to eat that.
Right.
It's like,
yeah.
I want to eat chicken nuggets or whatever it is. Yeah. And it's like, all right. It's like, what are you supposed to do? It's
yeah.
like... drill
each
it in
their own.
Yeah, of course. Like everyone gets to choose whatever they is the most important to them, I guess. So tell me a little bit about your philosophy on Ashtanga yoga. Like why do you feel like it works for you, and why do you think it works for other people?
I think what makes Ashtanga work so well, and I'm comparing it to other types of yoga because, as I said, I did some other types of yoga before I did Ashtanga. But I think it's the focus on Tristana, or having that as the base for the physical practice. I think we always come to asana first, so I'm just going to start with that. But so basically having these tools of the breath and the looking place and the asana itself, and the bandhas are intertwined with the breath, I would say, really helps to cultivate stillness of the mind. And I think that we get so wrapped up in other types of yoga, in like, of course, also this is a trap for Ashtanga, but what we're wearing, what kind of green juice we're drinking after the practice, and who we're hanging out with. I mean, I've been to California, so yeah. I've seen like the height of it.
Of course.
Yeah. So, but with Ashtanga, when you come into the room and you are not allowed to look around, and you have to focus on that sound of the breath, because, I mean, you have to consciously do that. You cannot passively breathe in this method. You have to be aware of when you're inhaling and exhaling, because it permits you to move. I think that helps to control the mind. And when you are able to have that stillness of mind and to be in the present moment, it so profoundly takes over the way that you interact with others, as you were saying earlier. The way that you're able to make decisions, especially for myself and in my life, I've found that. And the way that you see, my perspective is completely different since I've started this method. And I tried other types of yoga before and it didn't have that effect on me. And I don't know if it's just because by that time I started practicing Ashtanga, I had already been practicing some other types of yoga. I don't know what it is, but in some way it came to me, and it continues to come to me with practicing this method. And that is my feeling of empathy and connection to myself and everything that's around me.
Cool. Yeah, that's really powerful. And so for someone who is like a self-described overthinker, do you feel like that your mind is actually more still now as you practice for the last 7 or 8 years?
I do. I definitely do. Because I make decisions quicker without being extremely worried. Of course, because it's my tendency, I still do feel a little bit of stress when I have to make decisions, but it's a lot easier. Or for example, the first day of this month, I'm practicing in the second row because I'm short, and you practice in the back because you're so tall.
Yeah.
But I saw you. I must have been in Adho Mukha Svanasana or something, and I saw you, and that was the first time I saw you, and I thought, oh, cool, Taylor's here.
Yeah.
That's cool. Okay, now I have to inhale, jump forward, you know. And whereas before, my mind would have been like, oh, Taylor's here. I wonder how he is. He looks so much thinner than ever before. What happened to him?
He's wasting away. Yeah.
No, you look good. You look healthy.
Thank you.
Wonder how Jess is. Is she here? How are the kids? They must look so much older now.
Sure.
Even though I didn't see them that long ago or whatever, you know, my mind would have just spiraled out of control.
Of course, yeah.
And so I check that. I realize that, oh, that's cool. I cultivated a good quality practice. And a good quality practice, it's really controversial to say because, of course, there's no bad quality practice, right?
Only any the one practice that you don't do.
Sure. Right. The non-existent practice.
Bad practice.
Right. So it's always important to show up on your mat and no discouragement. But if you're able to check yourself and be like, my thoughts are spiraling out of control, maybe I can return to the breath or whatever it is that most is able to capture my attention, maybe the drishti or the breathing, or the asana if it's very difficult. Like, how are you? Like, I'm certainly not thinking in Karandavasana. Like, that is like...
It's not possible.
Yeah. It's amazing at capturing the mind. Yeah, so if you're like, oh, I'm starting to think about this, and then that's going to lead to that. And if you can just check yourself and be like, my mind's starting to wander, oh, let me just return to this aspect of Trisana that helps me, then that is a really good quality of practice. And I think that's why Ashtanga is so powerful, more so than other practices for me.
Yeah, yeah. It's very interesting to see, like, how the practice affects so many people. I mean, especially the people here, too, in Mysore. It's like, you know, like so many people here practicing, working their butts off in the room, and it's like, it's transformative just by that. And I guess the other thing I would ask you is, like, why do you think it's important that someone comes to Mysore? Do they not need to come to Mysore?
It's so hard to say because I'm so biased and I really don't want to come across as a person that's super close-minded to other people's approaches. But I had that first teacher, Ashtanga teacher in Barcelona. That was my first Ashtanga teacher. And then we left Barcelona about 6-7 months later and I didn't have anybody to go to, so I came straight here.
Yeah.
And I wasn't finished primary. And so Shiraji is my teacher, you know. And this, I had also been discouraged from coming here before I came. I was told it's really dirty, people are not friendly, everybody pushes each other to get into the shala, and there's so many students you won't get adjusted, and that... I felt really worried about coming before I did, but I knew that I had to because this is where this practice started. And so if you're doing something every single day and the place where it started still exists and there is a lineage holder who wants to be there for the community and offer you his years and years and years of wisdom, I mean, just go check it out, right? You're doing it every day.
You're doing it every day. It's like, why would you not come? I remember I was so scared, and I told this to your brother too. I was so scared to walk into the room the very first time. It was like, because you see it on YouTube and you hear the stories and people are pushing and, you know, people are mean and maybe some of those are true and some of them are not or whatever. But I walked into that room and I was like, oh man, this is, whoa.
This is it.
Yeah. It's like, I remember I had, I wasn't in the first time slot the first year. I was at 5 o'clock. So instead of 4:30, I was 5 o'clock. And I sat at the door because I was the first one there. I mean, there was only a couple of people that had 5 o'clock time slots. Yeah. So I sat at the door and I watched all these people and I was like, what in the hell am I doing here? You know, like, what am I doing? I just don't even know. Like, how did this kid show up at this place?
Right.
But it's been really transformative. And it's also amazing just to see Sharat, like, you know, hold this stuff down, you know, like to continue to teach us. And
I hope I can be half as good as he is.
Yeah.
I mean, the way that he conducts himself and the way that he controls the room, the way that he treats everybody the same, and the way that he sees you I mean, if you think that he doesn't see you, then you're wrong. Yeah. You know, he knows what's going on, and I know because I've assisted him. Yeah. He knows everything.
Yeah. And he even jokes about that from time to time. Yeah. I see everything. I know everything or whatever.
Totally. And, it's like, and I'm just like,
yeah,
whoa.
Yeah, you do. I've assisted several times, and it's always mind-boggling to see how he can pay attention to 80 people, treat them all the same, but teach them differently.
Totally. You know?
And that's a really powerful thing. I mean, I feel like assisting in the shala has been one of the most powerful things for my teaching. You know, to see him teach a certain person this way and another person, you know, another way, and give someone a hard time and give someone an easier time, or be more nurturing or whatever.
And this is like an inherent part of his personality, you know, because I mean, when I went to school in Dubai, when I went to high school in Dubai before I moved to South Africa, then Ethan and I went to a school. We were the only white kids there. Mm-hmm. It was mainly Indian kids. Okay. And so from that, I know that Indian families, especially from this part of India, are very strict.
Yeah.
And they expect things to be a certain way. And so for him to be interacting with all of these people from all over the world that might not be in line with Indian standards, you know, like wearing tiny outfits, right, or having like a lot of tattoos.
Yeah.
Or, I don't know, like even your sexual orientation or things like that, you know, parts of the world are not free. They sometimes have these really outdated constraints, like, oh, that person has tattoos, that means that they must not be good or something, you know?
Yeah, of course.
So to see him from this part of India and having to deal with all of us, like how different we all are, I see him, he treats us all the same.
Yeah. Yeah, in that aspect, of course he does. It's really actually quite powerful to see him treat everyone like that. So,
yeah.
And so tell us a little bit about your teaching, because I know you've been doing a lot of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I see, you know, the social media posts, or I see that you're teaching in a, you know, specific spot. You recently went to Toledo and you did a workshop at
That was so awesome. Before Shiraji gave me permission to teach this method, I started assisting at a shala, and I did that for many months, and then over the span of a year. And then I started traveling because I didn't know where I wanted to live. You know, I went to boarding school when I was 16, and I never lived at home since then.
Wow.
So I've been moving for a lot of my life, half of it.
Wow.
And I just didn't know where I wanted to live. So I've been traveling and teaching for some years. And I think it's been really good for me. And I tend to go back to the same places so that I can build a relationship with the students. But next year I'll be teaching in Prague for 7 months, which is the longest I've been in one place in many years. Yeah.
That's a long time.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really, really good for me. And hopefully I can bring something wonderful to the community as well. If I can just be there to facilitate the class, make sure that everybody's safe, and have a very loving disposition. Yeah. I think it's sometimes really to my downfall. Actually, I'm very soft. I'm very, like, I don't know. But,
Well, I mean, and why you feel like that's a problem in the Mysore room?
Not really. Not in the Mysore room. Yeah. No, I just meant it's like really, it's an inherent part of my personality. It's just a part of who I am. So sometimes I think people that love a lot, I think they get hurt a lot as well.
Yeah. That's true.
Yeah. Just because I think when you give so much, you get expectations, and expectations is the root of pain.
Yeah.
Really. I mean,
it's the root of resentment as well.
Totally.
Yeah. It can make people very sick.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Expectation breeds resentment. And if you don't handle expectations, a lot of times, like, it's one of the things in my sobriety that it's like you can't have expectations of people. And the reason why is because you'll just end up resenting them. I've had to work on that a lot because so it's really, it is an interesting thing.
And do you feel like the practice helps you with that? Or
totally.
Yeah.
I mean, and also 12-step, like the 12-step community has really helped me with that as well. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, because I'm able to look at it and it's like, and not put anyone up on a pedestal or not over expect what, you know, it's like, I usually, if I ask someone to do something for me, I like set the bar like really low.
What do you think about people's expectations of you?
I mean, I think that that's their problem.
Right.
Yeah. People with, you know, expectations of me who want to put me up on a pedestal or whatever, I'm bound to fall. I'm bound to, like, not look good in their eyes in some aspects. And that's happened to me before.
Right.
We've been dealing with a situation for a really long time of, you know, a couple people harassing us and over and over.
Some of that.
Yeah, it was a really rough situation, but it all bred from resentment. You know, you put me up on a pedestal, and then it's like you try and tear me down as a result of it. And it, you know, it's interesting to talk about, but you're not in control of other people's, you know, your feeling or their feelings or their expectations of you. It's like,
but as a Mysore teacher, the holder of space, you know, totally. The opener of the door, yeah. The gatekeeper of the next asana, right? You inevitably, the students, you know, they put something on you.
Yeah.
They think that you're like this beautiful being, and it's not necessarily the case. I mean, maybe for you it is, but, you know,
it's not always the, you know, that's not always the case. I mean, it's like, you know, a lot of times they put or transfer any negative or positive relationship that they've ever had, and they put it right on you. Being a Mysore teacher is like basically, in my opinion, more like a psychotherapist. You know, it's like there's so much transference that happens where all of a sudden you become someone's wife, or you become someone's husband, or you become someone's boyfriend, or this unresolved trauma that happens, like it gets transferred onto you because the practice is so transformative.
Yeah.
You know, like it gets things moving, all of these emotions that we store in our bodies. I mean, we get to a spot where all of a sudden, like those emotions rise up, and then we have to deal with the trauma of like having our heart broken, or having a dad that didn't love us, or having a mom that, you know, abused us, or whatever it was,
right.
You know, and we have to deal with that. And so instead of, you know, this practice is so powerful, instead of like someone, you know, if they have a good teacher, they can take responsibility for their own health, and maybe the teacher can steer them in the right direction. But a lot of times it goes the other way.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the key characteristics of a really good teacher is to have really strong boundaries.
Yeah.
There's like, you're the student, you're here to learn this. This is all I have to offer you and nothing more. I think that's really, really important. But it
still happens though.
It's hard.
Yeah, totally
even like I just care so much about them, you know, that when they're having a really tough time, I feel like I do want to listen because that's a part of who I am.
Yeah.
But I think that's not necessarily the best way to go about it. I think that's not for the student-teacher relationship. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. You know, there's a lot of different, different opinions of it. It's like, you know, when I was in Mysore, just think about how much transference happens to Sharat.
Right.
People would be like, oh, he hasn't talked to me he doesn't know my name. He hasn't talked to me. I haven't gotten a new asana the whole year.
Yeah.
You know,
it's
like, or is he mad at me? Like, did he, you know, did I do something that made him upset? Or, you know, there's so much weird stuff, but boundaries is the key. And Sharat has, we have an amazing teacher for boundaries. You know, it's like, even if you go in and talk to him in his office and you have to tell him something really personal, he's like, I'm sorry that you're going through something that you're going through. It's like, you know, just keep practicing, keep doing, you know, it's like there's a wall.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing. It's not a bad thing. It's to protect him
and
also to protect the students as well.
We also have to protect ourselves as teachers.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah. Pretty crazy. So where else is your teaching going to lead you to?
After Prague, I will finish in Prague at the end of August, and then I'm so fortunate I get to go to Shirachi's workshop in Madrid.
Awesome.
Yeah, for 1 week, beginning of September, and then I'll teach in Norway for 4 weeks.
Wow.
And then I hope very much that I get into the Shala and can come back and focus on my own practice after that very busy year.
You like teaching?
I love teaching.
Love teaching.
I definitely think that life would be easier without it if I just had, you know, because I just focus on my own practice and I don't have to lift these heavy bodies and, you know, but there's something about it. And Shirachi was talking about it in conference, that he gets totally involved in it. And I totally identify with that feeling.
When he said that, I was like, that's what it is. Yeah.
You look at the person and you wonder, how can I help that person to become more comfortable in what they're doing right now? Is it by them having to repeat it many times? Is it because, you know, structurally something's not working out there? Can I like assist them in some way verbally, get them to do it by themselves so that the magic in their eyes like lights up, you know, like how can I help this situation? And I find that my mind never wanders. It's another kind of spiritual practice because it keeps you so present. If you're really, really invested in the room at the time, it's so interesting to really watch and to totally be present, but it takes a lot out of you as well. Like I feel like mentally, just from paying attention for so long, like I feel really tired afterwards.
I go home, we have like 4-hour classes in the morning, and I get home and I just like turn the shower on, cuddle up into a ball and just like, you know, because sometimes there's so much energetic and sweat and, you know.
Yeah, it's really so full on. So like all around the world at different times, more or less around like 9:30, 10 o'clock, whenever the Mysore program's finished, there's all these Ashtanga teachers curled up in a ball in the shower.
in the shower, crying. I hope I help them today.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, that's so funny.
Yeah.
But mainly, when Shirakji gives his permission for you to teach, it's not, oh, if you would like to teach, here you go.
Yeah.
It's, hey, you have to spread this method because now you know this many vinyasas correctly. You're able to watch a room. You have this much experience of your own personal practice. You understand your body and you can help me in the shala assisting, and therefore you understand many bodies. Please do this as a service, as a thank you for understanding that this makes your life so much better and you can bring that to other people too. So it doesn't matter if you like it or not. You have to learn to love it.
Yeah. Yeah, I loved it. And I always felt like when I was given authorization that it was almost a responsibility to share it. You know, it's like my story is obviously different than everyone else's story. And it's also quite dramatic in some aspects. And so I felt like it was a responsibility to share it, you know? So it's good that you put it that way, because I totally feel that too. It's like, yeah, you learn to love it. It's hard. It's rewarding, you know, teaching, but it's also, it's the hardest work that I've ever done in my life, you know?
Yeah.
So,
how wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Robin, I really appreciate you being on the show. It's been amazing to kind of hear your perspective and your story, and it was just a great conversation.
Yeah, so, it really was. Thank you so much for coming over.
Hey guys, thanks for tuning in. If you want more information about Ashtanga Yoga, visit ashtangayogacolumbus.com. You can also check out my website, which is taylorhuntyoga.com. See you guys next time.